show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. Folks, we the news kind of slowly starting to trickle up. You kind of feel the slow build as we head towards the winter meetings yet again, where we hopefully we'll see some action. And historically, we've seen some with the Royals. We'll get into a little bit of that later. First, introductions, of course. I am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, the unseasonably warm, much like today, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this? It's like in the 70s right now.
Yeah, we're
in November.
Like a week away from Thanksgiving. And it's, yeah.
Yes.
Makes no sense. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm here. I'm better than last week.
You are, in fact, here. Well, you're there. I'm here. But great. We're here through the magic of podcasting. And that's what matters.
Technology.
So, yay, technology. So anyway, well, we've got some news items we'll get out of the way kind of quickly here first. Number one is Kendrys Morales. So we talked about him, how, you know, it didn't make sense for the Royals to necessarily give him the qualifying offer, but it would make sense to try and sign him to some sort of a deal, because, you know, you don't want to see that much power, especially for a Royals team devoid mostly of power, to see that much walk out the door. But that's over and done with now. He has signed with, of all teams, the Toronto Blue Jays. 3 years, $33 million. I mean, that, I don't know. Let's see. How old did you say? 33
he is? 33, and I think he'll turn 34 before the season starts.
Before the season. So he'll be getting $11 million as a 37-year-old, essentially. I'm not sure if it structures that way, but from an AAV standpoint, that's what he'll be getting. You know, you contrast that with what Billy Butler got last year, or I'm sorry, 2 years ago. You know, 10 years, good lord.
that would have been
3 years, $30 million, $10 million per year is where I was going with that. So, you know, the price went up a little bit, but Butler was younger than Morales is, and, you know, he wasn't coming off quite the couple seasons. You know, in his 2014-2013 seasons weren't as good as Morales has been the past two seasons, so there's also that to factor in. But you know, it's interesting, and it's, I wonder if, you know, playing in Toronto is going to have an impact on Morales's statistics. And I wonder if perhaps the man in white will lead the way to him having a 40 home run season. Who knows? I don't. I certainly don't. But this also would kind of give people hints as to how the Blue Jays want to handle the Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista situations, which is to say one of them or both will be gone. There hasn't been any news on that front, have there? I've been a little out of touch this week, to be honest. My child has been sick. The sleeping has been less than I would enjoy. But all the same, I'm here. But haven't missed anything on the Edwin Encarnacion, Jose Bautista fronts, have I?
No, they're going to be out there, and Encarnacion, I'm sure, will sign somewhere. I heard Boston's really interested. Bautista may still stick around, but he did reject his qualifying offer, so, you know, he's a free agent. So I figure if they keep anybody, it would be Bautista, because Encarnacion, he can play first, but you really would rather him be your DH.
And Encarnacion, I mean, he's similar, very similar situation to Morales. He's 33. He will turn 34 before next season. I mean, his season last year, he had 42 home runs, so quite a bit more than Morales at 30.
Not bad.
And the last, let's see, five seasons, he's hit no less than 34 home runs. So, you know, he's definitely got more power, but then you look, you know, his slash line of 263, 357, 529, you know, somewhat, you know, a little, again, the more power, the more slugging. But other than that, you know, similar to Morales. So, I mean, he's a better player. So you would imagine he's going to get, you know, maybe he gets, I don't know, 345. Is that too much? You think that's too much for an Edwin Encarnacion? At 34 years old by the start of next season. His birthday is in January, so I've got his baseball reference page pulled up right now. That's how I know. But so
I don't know. I think he can cash in. I mean, I haven't even looked at estimates on him because he's not even going to be in the Royals, you know,
no.
discussion. No. So I haven't really worried that much about him. But yeah, I mean, I think he could approach $15, $20 million a year. I guess that's a pretty wide range, but I mean, he's got a track record, so he's going to hit for power. I think Morales will too, especially in Toronto. Plus, he's going to play more games in the AL East, which is Baltimore and New York and Boston. So those are some friendly stadiums, especially New York if he's hitting from the left side when visiting. So yeah, I think he'll definitely get, as long as he's healthy, he should be able to surpass 30 homers for at least one or two of those years, and then we'll see how he ages. But yeah, that deal really puts the Billy Butler deal into a weird perspective, because Butler was not good. I mean, he hit 9 homers that year in 2014 when he left the Royals, and he really wasn't that good all year. You know, he had his moments, but you know, definitely not the 2012 Billy Butler that we saw, or even the 2013 Butler, who was a little more on his normal path. So, yeah, an extra million a year for the same length of time for an older player, it's a pretty good deal for Toronto. I think the Royals were iffy on going for those, you know, the extra years on it. You know, they probably wanted more of a two-year thing and maybe just a one-year deal just to get through. So, they seemed like they were prepared to lose him, but
so to kind of cap off that discussion, you know, where's that coming from? Where 30 home runs, and was it 94 RBIs he had? Where did they get that from? And then in this next coming year, I don't know that I have an answer.
Well, Moustakas will be back, so that should be a bump. Gordon.
So, but here's a question though, because like let's pull up Chester Cuthbert's stats, like, because because you can't play both of them. I mean, theoretically you can, but that's, I don't think that's what the Royals intend to do.
Right.
So, you know, Cuthbert had 12 home runs and 46 RBIs. So, how much better than that do you think Moustakas is going to be, plus making up for what Morales is lost? You know what I mean? So it's really, and then if you factor in what Moustakas did before he got injured, he had like 7 home runs already at that point, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's 19 home runs and call it 65 RBIs from that position. I mean, you think he's going to be that much better than that next year? I'd be stoked. If he gave us 19 home runs and 65 RBIs next year, I'd be stoked.
You mean Cuthbert or Moustakas?
Moose, sorry.
I think he could.
I mean, I'd want some more RBIs for sure, but like, just, you know, in general, like, that's a pretty solid season from Moustakas, given.
Yeah, I think he's a guy you could probably figure on 20 homers a year from him. I mean, he's got that kind of a power power swing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as, you know, obviously he doesn't get all pull happy and crazy like up until, you know, the 2015 season. But if he's the same kind of guy like 2015, I mean, that's 20 homers. Plus, you know, the way he started last year, it felt like, you know, he was on a really good pace and then he just kind of kept getting hurt in kind of freakish ways. So, I think he can probably get to 20. So that's 13 homers. Cuthbert may DH a significant amount of time. They might use Dozier there. They might, you know, rotate guys and maybe have an extra guy that plays, you know, here and there a couple times a week, like Bonifacio or something maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure where – I don't think they're necessarily going to recover the same 30 homers. But at the same time, Morales was like a 795 OPS. So while he had a lot of home runs, his overall kind of cumulative line wasn't like otherworldly. It's not like he was a 900 OPS guy.
Absolutely.
He was,
that's valid. That's incredible. That's –
He
Very
was
valid point.
He was good for the power and he did drive in the runs, but I think they can replace a lot of that, maybe not as many home runs. But I don't, it's tough cuz I mean we're going to watch him hit probably 35 homers next year in Toronto. It's just that kind of a stadium. But people will have to keep in mind that he wasn't going to be doing that in the AL Central.
No.
So, I mean, when you've got Target Field and Comerica, which those are tougher stadiums to hit homers in, and you'd be playing in those, you know, significantly more. You know, you'd be playing one series a year versus three or four. And plus Kauffman Stadium, obviously. You know, half your games there is going to suppress your home run numbers. It's just, it's,
well,
it's.
We did
it's
that
math.
Experiment. We did that experiment like a year or two ago, didn't we? I can't remember what brought it up. Was it Jose Bautista maybe even that we were looking at and seeing, you know, doing the overlay of the home runs? Maybe it was Miguel Cabrera or something.
I don't remember what the inspiration was, but.
But
I
you
mean,
remember what we were talking about, though, where we did the overlay of Kauffman Stadium and found someone's home run total decreased by like 5 to 7, you know, for a season. I mean, it's.
It definitely suppresses it. But at the same time, the Royals have always had, you know, they've always had players that generally were not home run hitters. So we also saw that the rate of home runs by the visiting team was generally higher, but still below average.
Yeah, Albert Pujols never seemed to have a problem hitting home
runs. No, he did not.
Stadium, so, no. You know, that it makes you wonder a little bit there, but.
Was peak Albert Pujols. That's
right.
No, that's absolutely tough.
But I'd be curious to see what he would do in Kauffman, though. I don't know. I've never really looked at the park factor for Busch Stadium and seen, you know, how that relates to Kauffman. I mean, they seem
really
like just average park
either.
To me. It just seems like it's not Camden Yards, you know, but it's also not Kauffman. So I don't, but I'd have to kind of dig into it a little bit more to be sure. But I'm guessing Albert Pujols, you know, when you're talking 2005 to 2011, Albert Pujols, super prime best player in baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, he's hitting 35 home runs no matter where he is.
You could put him in Yellowstone. He's going to hit 35 out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty much.
And to your point about Moustakas earlier, I remember getting so excited early on in the season. He was on such a good home run pace, like in 2012 when Butler was, you know, especially after the All-Star break when he had really started picking up the home runs. And I guess that was before the All-Star break, wasn't it? Really,
it was June and July were like the peak times. And then in August, I think he hit one home run or no home runs. Like he just
so
completely
he
hit a wall.
Dropped off. And then
like
he
was probably trying to hit him.
Right.
Maybe.
Because I remember it was getting close in like late August. I think he might have kind of started to pick back up again. And I would, every time he'd hit a home run, I remember I would tweet out his home run on, you know, which game his home run total was and then his pace and compare it to Balboni's at the time. Because like through August, it was actually really close. And so there was a. Or through July, maybe. I can't remember exactly, but, you know, then he kind of had his fall off. And once he did, then it was like, oh, this isn't fun anymore. But I was excited because I was like, man, maybe I can, that'd be kind of a fun thing to do for Moose if he gets close. And then, of course, he tears his ACL. Yeah. And next thing you know, we're Chester Cuthbert is not sniffing the current Royals home run record at this point in time. But I guess the final,
I don't think so.
Final bow on this topic. I mean, do you think if we just want to look the point you brought up of the 795 OPS, you know, say 780 is the goal to mm-hmm. be, you know, roughly representative to get you enough. Do you think a rotating DH / player structure between Moose, Dozier, Cuthbert, and Perez, do you think that, I guess you'd have to throw
maybe Gordon and Hosmer on occasion, you know, they might get a couple
who's
games like
is,
that.
Is I feel bad for not knowing this, is Butera under contract?
He is a free agent,
that's what I thought. Yeah. So whoever the backup catcher is then would have to be involved in that. But do you think that crew with kind of those core people there can get you from the DH spot throughout the course of a year, what Morales did?
Probably not. You know, I think that a lot of it would come down to Cuthbert and what he'd be able to do. You know, because I would imagine at this stage he's probably the guy you would expect to get the most time. I mean, he hit well enough last year. Towards the end of the year, he kind of started to tumble, like, you know, September, career minor leaguer, you know, probably hit a wall. Maybe the conditioning wasn't there at the end like it was, and he just tired out. He finished with a 731 OPS. So, you know, if he has some gains in that kind of, or at least doesn't lose it at the end of the year, then, yeah, maybe he could. If he was a little more patient and walked a little bit more, that might be something too. So, you know, I think modest gains could get him pretty close to that, to at least that OPS. And then if he gives you 12 to 15 homers, you probably feel okay about it. It'd certainly be, it should be better than average for what most teams get out of their DH spot, unless they have Victor Martinez and, David Ortiz and, you know, maybe Mike Napoli and stuff like that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe the other thing is, there's speculation. There are a lot of people, you know, they always do these lists of, hey, here's where the free agents will end up. And a lot of people, like Jim Bowden, and I think maybe did Morosi do one? I don't know who else did one, but, a lot of people like Matt Holliday in that kind of a spot, you know, could play
That's
outfield
true.
If you needed him to, could fill in at first here and there. Could definitely DH, and you know, I think he could be 20 homers and hit 280, and he could easily replace Morales, and he could probably do it for a 1 year deal at you know, $10-12 million. So you'd basically get about the same deal for a lower commitment and maybe not miss a beat, you know. So that could be something interesting to kind of watch. And we were talking about that a little bit in the BP Kansas City chat of, it'd just be fun to sign a former Cardinal just because,
yeah,
especially if they do well, you know, especially when it's like Matt Holliday, who's slightly iconic, I guess. I mean, for this era, at least for the last, you know, 5 to 8 years or so,
mm-hmm.
you know, where he's been one of their kind of primary marketable type of guys.
Well, they were ready to make him the GOAT in 2011. You know, when it was game 6 and they were trailing to the Rangers before David Fries worked his magic, right? Matt Holliday made a couple errors in the outfield, or like one error and then like another bad decision or something. Do you remember?
I remember mostly the Nelson Cruz play and Fries hitting the walk-off. And that's most of what I remember from that World Series.
All right, we're going to look this up because I got to figure this out. Because there was something. I just remember.
I'm sure they were calm and reasonable in their critiques.
Oh, absolutely. There was some miscommunication with Rafael Furcal between him and Holliday. And, oh, there's a link. There's a replay. Okay. Oh, there it was. Yeah, miscommunication between who had the ball. It shows him right here. And then it bounces off of Holliday's gloves and he misses the play. He misses the out. And then I think they lost the lead after that. It was a tie game. So they then started trailing after that. So that's what it was. So I remember they're just going up in arms about that. And then, of course, I think he had a home run later, had like a huge hit at some point. And, you know, then it was all
right.
They, all better.
They came back pretty quick.
Yes. So anyway, that was a fun little trip down memory lane. But with that, we'll talk about our next segment or next little bit of news. The Baseball America came out with their top 10 prospect list. Now, a few years ago, this would have been all over everything Royals, talking about the top 10 prospect list. But there's less fervor over the minor league system. Now that the Royals major league team is actually worth watching, but it's still, excuse me, still relevant, still worth talking about, obviously. So the top 10 lists go like this. I'm gonna say it out, Mike. I'm gonna get your thoughts on it here.
Okay.
So, we start with 1 Stomont, 2 Strom, 3 Dozier, 4 Skoglund, 5 Puckett, 6. I guess we should throw in first names here. I gotta be honest. Matt Stomont, is that? I don't even know his first name.
Josh Stomont.
My bad. Yeah. Matt Strom, number 2. Hunter Dozier, number 3, that seems high. Skoglund, I don't even know his first name.
Eric Skoglund. Eric. Very Norwegian type of Norse.
Yes, this is how out of touch I've been with these things recently.
I mean, you can either focus all your energy on the contention or on the prospects. And it's like, I choose to follow the major league team closer. And this is nothing new to anybody who's listened to us the last few years.
Puckett, God, I don't know his.
AJ Puckett, last year's first Scott round Blewett, or second that. Round pick. Yep, Scott Blewett.
Chase Vallett. Is it Velo? How did you pronounce it?
I pronounce it Velo because that's what Jim Callis pronounced it when we talked to him last March. So Velo.
That's for me. Then Ryan O'Hearn is number 8. Jorge Bonifacio, number 9. Familiar name. And finally, the great white whale, as you put it, Mike, of pitching and just prospects in general. Kyle Zimmer rounds out the top 10
list.
Kyle
Zimmer.
So we struggled through that due to my lack of first name knowledge, but seeing that list, what were your initial impressions from that?
Well, I don't ever really hear a lot about Skoglund, so he's never really stood out to me that much, but the Royals are impressed with him. Zimmer being in there at all is kind of surprising because, I mean, I guess it shows what stuff will get you. That'll hold you for a while. It also shows you where the Royals system is, that a guy like Zimmer is still in their top 10 because he really hasn't done anything the last couple of years. Strom, we saw him last year. We saw a little bit of Dozier. I think Puckett's probably a quick riser. Ryan O'Hearn has been playing pretty well in the Arizona Fall League. Stomont's interesting in that, he's got a really good curveball. His fastball is his best weapon, but his control is off. You know, he's not a great guy with control. He's very much kind of in a, like, I don't have Randy Johnson's early career numbers in front of me, and I'm not by any means comparing Stomont to Randy Johnson. But it seems like he's either all the way on or he's all the way off. And if you look at just in his Arizona Fall League, he's thrown 24 innings. He struck out 30, but he's walked 16. But in these are, partial starts. His Arizona Fall League, they're not going to work a guy all the way. He's made 7 starts. In 5 of them, he's given up 0 runs. And in 5 of those, he's given up only 7 total hits. But in the remaining 2, he's gave up, here's where he walked a couple. Here's where he gave up 4 earned runs. Here's where he gave up 7. So, it's like all or nothing. Right now, it's more of the all, at least in the Arizona Fall League. But this is his kind of pattern. So, he's maybe somebody that is mostly AA, AAA next year. But maybe if he's pitching well, they give him the kind of Matt Strom treatment, where they bring him up out of the bullpen. If they were able to get the starting pitching to make it so that they could just add Strom and Stomont out of the bullpen, that's nuts. Man. That's just like it's literally the Cyborg factory. But he's got to control. You know, he's got to prevent the walks. You know, as we talk about all the time, walks or pitches. You know, just blows up your pitch count. And it's not a surprise that Danny Duffy had his breakout by controlling his walks, because that allowed him to get through the game. You know, deeper into a game, he pitched more efficiently. He pitched better. He was in better pitchers counts. So those are the things that Stammont has to do. But, you know, every report on him is, you know, they bring up the fastball and his curveball is good. And his changeup is one of those. I think in the scouting report from Baseball America, they said he throws it because he knows he's supposed to throw it, because they do still intend to have him be a starter long term. So he'll be interesting to kind of see how he develops, but kind of surprised he's number one, but really I can't really pick out any other person that I would put ahead of him. You know, maybe Strom.
Yeah, but, I mean, that's
there's no real
kind of the
standout.
Weird situation where you say exactly, you know, point being, I guess there's no clear-cut number one in this system, which
yeah we'll see when the baseball prospectus ones pop up, and we'll see where they rank these guys, and I'm sure it will probably be a similar list but maybe a different order. But
I was actually kind of surprised to see Hunter Dozier so high. I mean, he had a pretty decent year last year and showed some things at the major league level, but you know, overall, I mean, it seems like the perspective on him has kind of declined the last couple of years, so that was kind of surprising.
He had a good bounce back, so
he did.
That's it's moving in the right direction. He looked fine from the limited at bats that we saw in September. You know, not much to go off of, but I mean, we'll see how much he plays this year. I'm not sure. They seem pretty comfortable with Orlando and Dyson, but if there's a trade or something else, or if they do try to use him as a DH more often, well, you know, maybe he'll rise to the occasion. He'll be interesting to kind of see too.
Yeah. And, you know, as kind of a final aside to this, we can two names that are auspiciously missing from this list. Can you guess where I'm going with this? At least with one of them, I'm sure you can.
One is easy as Bubba Starling.
That's correct. Bubba Starling. So
I couldn't even consider him probably in the top 30 anymore. I mean,
no, I mean the shine is off. Has been
right
for any remaining shine is completely gone. And before I maybe thought it was 50-50. I maybe thought he might get to the major leagues as like a defensive guy, and just kind of anything you can get from him offensively would be great. But I truly do not think we will ever see Bubba Starling in the major leagues as a Royal.
I think we'll see him in the big leagues with the Royals only to say that he made it to the big leagues with the Royals.
Like, I suppose that's possible.
Like, oh, someone's hurt. Let's bring him up, because he's already on the 40 man. So
that's true.
They may as well go ahead and do it. If they need somebody, even if he was just a defensive, like if he had the Terrence Gore role, he could probably do that, frankly, with maybe some upside of power, because Terrence Gore is, you know, super fast, but he's not great defensively and he doesn't hit, and he's not going to hit big league pitching. But Bubba Starling might accidentally run into one every now and then. But
right,
I really wouldn't count on that. And you don't want to spend, what was it, $6 million to $8 million on him for his bonus?
That was like, it was 7.5.
You don't want to do that and just have him be this pinch runner defensive replacement. But, you know, if that's the only way to get any value out of him, you know,
and
maybe.
Yeah. The second name is Ash Russell.
Oh, yeah.
Recent first round draft pick, you know, supposed to be a big, you know, big arm, a young starting pitcher, kind of raw, but supposedly could develop and has not developed at all. And, you know, I believe it was you that posted in our Baseball Prospectus chat room thing that the JJ Cooper response when asked about Ash Russell, and the response just being that, you know, there's still hope there, kind of in the vein of, well, there's always hope.
Right.
But those are my words, not his. But he did say there was still hope there, but that 2016 was an objective disaster, and there's no indication that it's getting any better for 2017. So it appears Ash Russell may go the way of the Colt Griffins of the world. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say, but that's, you know, the Royals have never, even in this regime, with some of the good drafts or good draft picks that they've had, just overall drafting, when you look 2006 to 2016, it hasn't been that great overall. You know, we can be honest about that while still allowing for the fact that they've had some good picks, you know, Greg Holland, obviously Hosmer Moustakas, you know, Duffy, you know, you could, it looks a little bit better when you throw in people from other teams, you know, that the Royals have either traded or whatever, you know, when you talk about, you know, John Lamb, Sean Manaea, and Will Myers and Mike Montgomery, and, you know, people that have made impacts on other teams. So it looks a little bit better, but still overall not that great. But even still, how they could miss so poorly on Ash Russell as a first round pick is kind of befuddling. You know, with the Bubba Starling thing, you at least see it. You see an incredible amount of athleticism, and, you know, someone who, and they said it at the time, you know, he's got an uphill climb, they said at the time, but if he climbs that hill, he's a league MVP type player because of the skill set that was there. It just never developed, you know, and he was a hometown kid in your backyard. You had the feeling was at the time, you had to pick Bubba Starling. You didn't have a choice, and that's kind of where the Royals, I think. So you can at least, regardless of whether you want to agree with any of that or stuff or not, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just completely outlandish. You understood where they came from, and, you know, it didn't work out. Those things happen. But, you know, Ash Russell, he wasn't, you know, the Royals had a, what was it, 23rd pick that year, whatever it was, and, you know, the Royals, he wasn't a hugely celebrated prospect, and, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but, you know, it was just kind of perplexing. I mean, they just completely whiffed, and, you know, even if, I guess I'd have to go back and look at all the first round picks, you know, that this regime has had.
No, I was just going to say, I was looking at that year's first round. There's, you know, not really anybody that they missed in the Ash Russell first round, but yeah, I mean, since Hosmer, really, I guess Aaron Crowe in 2009, they got something out of him, Christian Colon in 2010, but, you know, that's about it. You know, that's not a great track record. Hunter Dozier made it up. Sean Manaea made it up as he was a supplemental pick.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, they haven't really turned a lot of those guys into, you know, much of anything. I mean, even the guys who came up, you know, Hochaver never really panned out as a starter.
No.
Moustakas struggled for so long. Hosmer.
I mean, we could go back through. I mean,
Hosmer's never really reached the potential.
Hosmer was 08.
Aaron Crowe was pretty good for a couple of years, and then he's been ineffective and hurt. Christian Colon was supposed to be this high floor but modest ceiling type of guy, but everyday second baseman type who could possibly play a shortstop. He hasn't been that guy. Bubba Starling, you know, we just talked about him. Kyle Zimmer has not done anything. Dozier, we'll see. 2014 was Finnegan. Still potential there to do something. Ash Russell, who knows, probably hurt. And then last year, AJ Puckett, who wasn't a first round pick, but second round, their first pick of that draft. So, you know, he's still got a chance too. But yeah, it's just not a great turnout.
We will go take our only break. And then when we come back on the other side, we've got some kind of discussions in terms of looking at the past for how the Royals can make moves for next season. So stick with us and we'll discuss that back on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages. The Vault.
And that was Sinfonia in A Major by Sam Martini. It's noted that the third vicar of Dunshire would play that every night before delivering sermons. It's a fine piece of music. It's 10 past the hour here on Vault Public Radio. We wanted to remind you, dear listener, that this week is Pledge Week at the Vault. Your support is vital, and giving to Vault Public Radio is one way to help support your community. And speaking of community, you won't find a better friendly community than the staff at Kelly's Westport Inn. Like public radio, Kelly's is a staple of the community, a standard, an icon, a Kansas City tradition. Fine patrons like yourself have been supporting Kelly's Westport Inn since 1947, when, I'd note, that Randall Kelly poured his first pint. Contribute to Vault Public Radio today, you can get an official VPR tote bag, or you could stop by Kelly's for an affordable pint, the best pizza in town, and a few games of Papa Shot. We're grateful for your support at VPR and for your support at Kelly's Westport Inn. Enjoy the tradition. And now, 4 hours of Best of the Baroque Period, followed by the Amstein Theaters and The Horse You Rode In On, hosted by Joseph Guevara Amherst.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Perspectives affiliate. So, as we mentioned before the break, we're coming up, it's inching closer toward the winter meetings, and, you know, we're in the hot stove season. Rumors are flying around, they're starting to kind of pick up. You can kind of feel it. There's a lot of distractions now with football season in full swing and college basketball season just started. You know, KU's got a really good team this year, so the local media is focused on them a lot, with possibly the best freshman in the country and Josh Jackson. So, you know, a lot of things to take away from Royals or baseball news, but it's there though. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but the winter meetings is usually where Dayton Moore, historically speaking, has made his move, and he's kind of had a historical pattern with that. You know, winter meetings, not to say exactly at the winter meetings, you know, but you know, that time frame of either ramping up towards it or maybe slightly after it, when he's made the, when he's you know, had time to discuss with other GMs and such there. So Mike, why don't you walk us through kind of the history of Dayton Moore at the winter meetings and some of the patterns he's established in terms of moves he's made for this team in the past?
Well, the thing with Dayton is he's always been really quick out of the gate in a lot of cases to make a kind of move of some sort. So, you know, you go back to like 2008, shortly after the season was over, they traded for Mike Jacobs. They traded later for Coco Crisp. They felt like 2009 was going to be a year where they might contend. Didn't really pan out that way. Nothing really came of it. 2009, they traded Mark Tian away. So, you know, trying to trade a veteran guy, they brought in Chris Getz at that point, which, you know, filled a need at second base, on paper at least. Never been a Getz fan, go figure. But then, you know, once you get into 2010, you can kind of tell that the wheels are turning as far as selling pieces off. You know, you'll remember in 2010, that was when they had Rick Ankiel and Kyle Farnsworth and traded them off and got Tim Collins. And They had Scott Podsednik and traded him off, and you know, just kind of basically trading veterans off for guys who might pan out. And so they traded David DeJesus for Justin Marks and Vin Mazzaro. But then it was later, you know, that's where they also traded Zach Greinke in December. And so, you know, the groundwork for that was set up in the winter meetings, and the deal was made shortly after. But that was a clear signal of, hey, we're going to rebuild. You know, and then 2011, they had the best farm system in the history of the universe. They had a pretty successful year. And at the end of that year, they traded Milky Cabrera for Jonathan Sanchez. You can kind of tell, all right, they're trading a surplus for a need. They got in Sanchez, who was a high-risk but high-reward pitcher. He was awful, but you can't fault them for trying, and you can definitely see where they were feeling like 2012 might be a year where they could contend. And you kind of see this, you know, in 2013, they traded Will Smith from Nori Aoki. They needed a leadoff hitter. They wanted an outfielder. It made sense. They had a surplus of arms. But the deal that we kind of really want to see as the kind of the signal for where they really felt like they were buying. You know, a lot of people would say James Shields, which was in the 2012 winter meetings. All of the groundwork for that was laid that week while they were cooped up in the hotel with every other baseball executive in the country. And Shields is going to be the big one. But the first one that really kind of sticks out is like, we are buying and we're going for it. We're going to add payroll. We're going to add a veteran. And it was Ervin Santana who was the Royals traded for him, not at the winter meetings, but it was on Halloween in 2012. And, you know, another deal right off the bat, another deal pretty quickly after the World Series. It actually came about because the Angels had a player option and they didn't really want to pay Santana $12 million to pitch for them. So it worked out, you know, that they decided that, you know, if they don't pick up the option, they're going to have to lose him with no compensation. So they at least took the option, and the Royals were right there ready to take him on. They traded Brandon Sisk, who was a 27-year-old career minor league lefty. I think he's still in the Angels system now, or maybe he just got released. You know, basically just trading a guy for the salary relief. But it worked out for what the Royals were looking for because they got a veteran arm with some upside who was coming off of a down year. And it was the Royals kind of speculating on Santana and his health and his abilities, plus the fact that they knew they had a good defensive team behind him. They knew that the ballpark was going to be friendly to him. And, you know, before they went out and got James Shields, they had to start with Santana. And so you're trading a guy that you don't really have much invested in for Santana. It's not as flashy as Will Myers for James Shields. But, you know, I think that the success of 2013, so much of it was based off of having Santana and Shields. And, you know, they really needed to get rotation help. Santana was a guy who came in and helped them immediately. And he was solid pretty much all season. And, you know, that kind of, to me, this example of Santana and where they are now, you know, as far as, you know, making that deal and kind of recognizing where they were in their path to contention, it seems to me like you can kind of get an idea from that first move where Dayton Moore feels like the team is. And so they have yet to really make that move. And so that's what I want to see, because it's such an interesting offseason, and 2017 is going to be such an interesting year. You know, do they go out and find a guy in a similar kind of situation like Santana, a veteran with some upside that they can trade for and get, you know, pretty limited loss from the organization standpoint, as far as who they lose, who they trade, if it's cash or a minor leaguer. You know, so that's what I'm looking for in relation to Santana and what the Royals' pattern is, because it feels to me like Dayton Moore is overdue to make that move at this stage. And it's not that I think he's itching to go make the move, but it feels like he's decisive early in the off season and is ready to take the plunge as soon as he sees the deal. So with so many things going on this off season, they still need pitching help. They could use outfield help. They could probably use a second baseman if they can get a veteran one. You know, is a similar kind of move out there for them? I don't know. I mean, it might strike us by surprise by who's available. Irvin Santana wasn't completely on the Royals' radar, as I recall it, back in the offseason of 2012. I remember Dan Heron was in a similar situation with the Angels, and it felt like the Royals would be more apt to go after him because he was more of a safe bet, more of an accomplished pitcher. But they went with Santana, and they kind of took a little bit of a risk, and it paid off for them. And so I want to see them make a similar type of move this offseason and kind of keep that pattern going where they feel like they're making a move to contend this year, and you can probably see by who they get back, you know, what their general feeling is on this year's team and down the line.
Yeah, and you know, it just as you said, he's overdue to make a move, and you know, he really needs to. Whether they have to do something, because obviously, you know, they won the World Series with the holes in, you know, right field and second base basically, but and the second baseman was mitigated by a midseason trade for Ben Zobrist.
Right.
But
Ben Zobrist isn't walking through that door.
No, he's not. Sadly. And so, you know, they were able to overcome in that season in 2014, of course. But, you know, they've had these holes for a while now. And my mantra in sports, whether it's football, basketball, whatever, baseball, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And, you know, the kind of philosophy behind that is that if you're not actively trying to get better and trying to get every inch of being better that you can, every other team is, right? So, you know, last season you looked and, you know, the White Sox made a lot of moves, but it didn't pay off for them because they run a terrible organization, you know, but they've made moves the past couple of seasons that make everyone think, okay, well, maybe they're going to compete now. And they started off hot last year. So, you know, it looked for a little bit like maybe it was working. You know, it seems like every year Cleveland's making some moves in the off season. They're bringing people in, you know, and Rose won the World Series in 2015, obviously amazing. But 2016, they didn't really make a ton of changes. You know, I think they thought, okay, their core is young. They've got, you know, the core can still get better with the Hosmers and the Moustakases of the world. And so, you know, let's just keep everyone together, focus on that, and kind of supplement. And I mean, really, the only, you know, really bold move they made, you know, was they signed Ian Kennedy, I guess, was the Ian Kennedy, and then Joaquin Soria. So, yeah. But you know, when you really think about it, if you look back at those two moves, well, you know, they're basically just replacements for, you know, Ian Kennedy basically just gave you what Jason Vargas did, who was out all season with an injury. And Joaquin Soria basically gave you what Greg Holland did in the season before. And, you know, he's obviously was out all season with injury, but wasn't even on the team. So, you know, those were kind of stopgaps more than they were really improvements, because they just kind of gave you what you already just filled what you already had, you know? So
yeah, they kept you in place, but they didn't
exactly.
They didn't improve.
Santana, Shields, Davis, those trades weren't just to keep the status quo. They were, we're getting better. We're going to take this step because we have these players in that can help us do that. So, you know, there were a lot of mitigating factors last year to why the Royals ended up 500 to follow up their World Series. Now, you know, whether you want to believe that they can just say, okay, those things aren't going to happen again and they'll be fine, they'll be better, you know, there's the I'll listen to that. That's valid based on what we know, but also, you know, why take why take that chance? What they need to do is they need to make a Santana move. You know, they the days we went over the top 10 in the farm system, you know, the Will Myers and the Mike Montgomerys of the world, they're not walking through that door either. So yeah. The idea that the Royals could pull off any type of a James Shields trade, I don't know that they want to, but even if they did, they just don't, they don't have the guns for it anymore, you know? So, cause the system is, you know, it's a bottom third farm system right now for Major League Baseball. And so it's going to have to be that kind of a fringy deal like the Santana thing. And that's why I think it's important that we highlighted it. Cause it's, you know, that's what we need to look for. And just as Santana's wasn't really on the radar, you know, I don't know if the Royals have anybody. I'm sure the Royals know, but, you know, we don't really know who the Royals have on radar as possible. You know, maybe kind of a small-time deal that could pay off big. But, you know, we do know, as you mentioned, especially in the last few years, Dayton Moore has been pretty savvy in some of those deals. And, you know, Santana was the start of those really kind of deceptively smart moves where I think we've seen enough of them now, especially when it comes to bullpen, that you can't just say, okay, we got lucky and Santana, you know, had a really good season and that was kind of it. Cause I mean, Santana has been pretty good since then, really, you know, for other teams that he has pitched for. I'm going to pull up his stats really quick. He had a suspension, you know, or two, but, you know, he's been pretty solid overall, ever since coming to, let's see for the last one, two, four seasons, he's pitched 696 innings and with a 3.59 ERA. So that's, you know, since his season with Kansas City. So, you know, there was something there. Yeah. He had 2012 was a bad season. And so the Angels were ready to dump him. The Royals were there to try and pick him back up. And maybe it's to the original point, I think you can say now Dayton Moore has an ability to recognize, okay, this is a guy that for whatever reason didn't have the success people wanted, whether it was just the most recent season. You know, we saw it with Edinson Volquez as well. You know, even though he, you know, did well in Pittsburgh, you know, there was still questions about his consistency, and he saw it for 2015. And so, you know, whoever's out there, I think we have confidence that Dayton Moore, if he's shown him a better ability to find that player in a major league setting than he has in terms of drafting, as we should, to kind of juxtapose the first part of our show with this one, you know, Ash Russells and Christian Colones and Bubba Starlings, those mistakes seem to be more prominent at the draft level, but, you know, get Irvin Santana's and James Shields and, you know, the Ryan Madsen's and Peter Moylan's of the world. Those, you know, whether it's free agent or trades, they seem to be a little bit more prominent at the major league level. And it gives you a little bit more faith that, you know, there's a move out there that maybe we don't quite see, but maybe Dayton Moore sees it and can make a lot of sense for the Royals and can really help them get back to the point where they're competing for a Central Division title, American League title, World Series title in 2017.
Yeah, they're going to have to be creative because they don't have the payroll space really to do much. I mean, that's going to be the toughest thing is they, you know, we want them to improve and granted, they say it every year that they're not going to bump up the payroll, but you know, it's one of these years you got to believe them because it's just literally going to be an issue. And this may be the year. It's also a weak free agent class this year. So, you know, I guess if there's a year to be limited on what you can spend when there's not much to spend it on, that might be the best way. You know, I think it'll be interesting to kind of see what they come up with. I think that if they are, it feels to me, and the anecdotal, I haven't sat down and mapped every single kind of transaction or like major transaction, but it seems like four out of every five they get pretty right. Kennedy was good last year. Santana back in 2013 had a good season. Chris Young was good in 2015. Madsen, like you said, Moylan, even going down to like Vargas for 2013 or for the 2014 season, Aoki when they traded for him, like those all panned out. The Sanchez sticks out as one that really didn't. You know,
but then he flipped that for Guthrie, who did.
Yeah, and they re-signed Guthrie right after, or at least shortly after Santana. I think it was over Thanksgiving, or at least the week of Thanksgiving when they re-signed Jeremy Guthrie, and Guthrie was pretty good in 2013 and okay in 2014, and then you know, kind of fell off.
Yeah,
but as you know, aging pitchers tend to do, but. They'll have to do something. They don't have as many players in their farm system to deal off. Plus, they're not in the same kind of position as they were at the end of 2012, where, you know, you look at 2013, 14, 15, and 16, you've got no losing seasons in all of those, plus two pennants in a World Series. That's what they're gearing up for and willing to sell off prospects to do so. This year, you know, it's like we've talked about. I mean, they feel like it's going to be their year to contend still, but they have to find that balance between continuing to build for the future and develop for the future, but still get impact guys and do so on a limited payroll. So it's not an enviable position, but if there is a spot where a team is looking to dump off a guy who has some ability left and maybe is just kind of under the radar, that's where the Royals are going to make their gains. And it's a move like this Santana move that's going to do it. It may even be Irvin Santana himself. He's still got a lot of years left on his contract, yeah. But he had a good year last year. The Twins have no real use for him because the Twins are going
I'd be okay with that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'd be fine with it. He pitched great last year. It seemed like if the Royals were buyers, he might have been a guy who would have done it, but you know, it's all about, you know, the money and how to make the prospects work and things like that.
So. And he's, I just happened to have, because since we were talking about him, I have his BREF page pulled up. And, I mean, he signed through 2018 on a 4-year, $55 million contract. So, I mean, he's making like $14 million a year, a little less. I mean, that's not, it's for what he gives you.
It's, you know, if you figure, I mean, it's never exact when you go off the wins above replacement per dollar kind of thing. But if it's $6.5-7 million a year, he just has to basically be an average pitcher and get you two wins above replacement and you break even.
Yep. And he had a 3.38 ERA last year and 181 innings. So, but I mean, not to say that Royals are targeting Irvin Santana, but it's, you know, that's a move that you could feasibly see being made that the Royals would have enough to probably pull off. Now, the question is, do the Twins want to deal within the division? You know, are they at the point where they're so far gone, so far out of it that they just say, you know, okay, we'll just get what we can? Or do they think, hey, you know, 2015 wasn't the aberration, you know, 2016 was. We can get back to 2015 where they were, you know, competitive for a brief period in the division before the Royals ran away with it. You know, who knows? But interesting thing to think about. So with that, I think we'll leave you. But the, you know, it'll be hopefully there'll be something similar to that we can say, you know, Dayton Moore did this and the Royals are a better team today than they were yesterday. They haven't really made any splashes yet, but we don't anticipate that they would. But yeah, Within the next couple weeks, it's realistic to think something, say there's something could go down, or we could start to hear the sprinklings of something possibly going down. And then once the winter meetings hit, we everything goes into full force. So until then, you know, we'll be here every week talking about Royals, and we'll kind of dig up some things kind of like we did with his Dayton Moore's past history that can possibly lead some relevance to where they're going as we enter bravely into the off season. So,
hot stove season warms up.
Warms up indeed, though. Warming up basically like out like it is outside, as it's still unseasonably warm. Yeah. So you know,
everything is thrown off this year.
Yes, the larger implications of what it means globally and scientifically that it's 68 degrees in November. I don't know that I will worry about at this moment, but I can kind of enjoy that it's like it's at least nice. So anyway, we'll leave you there. And we'll be back next week to talk more Royals. Thank you all so much for listening. We couldn't do it without you all as our listeners. We greatly appreciate it. So if you have any feedback for us, hit us up at the usual places. We'll stick with us all off season because we'll have plenty to talk about, and we'll be back every week. So thanks for listening. Until next time, thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to KansasCityBaseballVault@gmail.com.